Last person coming in. Would you please close the door behind you? Thank you.
Don't let the cold air out.
Yeah. This side too. This side too. The freezer. We want to keep the temperature.
It's quiet. Let's just leave the side doors open.
That's okay. All right. Welcome back, everybody. This is definitely a pleasure. It's the last speech for the day, for this conference, in fact. And after this is a closing summary, and then followed by a panel. And the panel is about FIPS and CC, how they play together. And the topic was chosen by you all and by popular vote at the end of last ICMC. We asked for suggestions on panel and what we would like to hear, and the popular vote was for CC and FIPS, how they play together. And so I would hope that most of you would be there and not bail out after this. All right. And the other thing that I wanted to say also is that, again, the slides will be available to you, and also the audio will be available to you. There is also, I think, page 3 has the details on where to get that. When you have a question, please come up to the microphone and then speak into the microphone, because we are recording that. And then what else do I have? This. All right. You will be sent us a survey. Please fill that out, and we do read everything that comes into that. Everything that, just not the numbering or the tick marks, but we also read the comments, and we do take that into account when we do the next ICMC, when we prepare for it. So please do give your comments. Written comments definitely are welcome. Okay, with that, I want to introduce the speaker, and maybe there's one more. Actually, all the other tracks, there's only 3 tracks going on at the time, at this moment, not 4 tracks. And all the other 2 tracks have 2 sessions going on, whereas this track has only 1. This is the final session for this track. And so you will have about 15 to 20 minutes in addition to their break time, right? After this, we'll have that 10, 15 minutes, and then the break, and then after that is the closing and the final panel. So that's all I have for in terms of announcements. Now, definitely, I'm coming to Daniel Bernstein. So our last speaker for the conference is Daniel Bernstein, and he has a very interesting topic: Thomas Jefferson and Apple versus the FBI. So I'm all eager to listen to that. And it's, Daniel comes from University of Illinois. Are you from university? Are you currently teaching? Or you did something in university?
I'm employed by the University of Illinois. I try to avoid teaching.
Awesome. Well, he is from the University of Illinois at Chicago, and that's all it said. No comma, Bernstein, Daniel comma, this thing. So I didn't know whether you were employed or you're studying. So he's from University of Illinois, and also another university somewhere in Netherlands. He's going to talk about that. I'm not trying to pronounce that at all.
All right, thanks. I figured I would start this talk with alcohol. People tell me that lots of great talks start with alcohol, so this is my attempt. This is a book called Home Winemaking for Dummies that you can find on Amazon. It's not the first book which explains home production of alcohol. People learn in school, kids learn that Gutenberg was printing the Bible, but they don't often learn that the printing press that Gutenberg invented was based on a wine press. Probably one of his first books was about wine, or maybe beer, depending on the kind of person he was. It just doesn't get advertised for the kids. Anyway, if you look at a book like this and you know somebody who maybe had their lives damaged or destroyed by overuse of alcohol, then you might actually think that this is not a topic to be laughing about, not a topic to be writing about, certainly not something for people to be doing. Maybe you know somebody whose life was destroyed by some other drugs. You might think the right way to deal with this is to have some law against the overuse of alcohol or the overuse of drugs in general. But it's kind of hard to enforce something like that. What's much easier to enforce is an absolute prohibition. Say, all right, we're going to stop anybody from having any of this substance, and then you don't have to figure out what the overuse means. You just prohibit the drug, that's the end of it. And maybe that's not quite enough. Maybe you start talking to people about trying to prevent anybody from knowing how to produce this drug. And I hear somebody saying that this is, providing a link. That's interesting. So a link is popping up as that is a correct link. That's actually to stlmedia.net. And I guess I won't be able to remove it because the entire slide is a link. Once the slides are online, you'll be able to click on that and see what the links are from. This is a St. Louis history site, which is various news clippings, like there's a bridge blown up in St. Louis down at the bottom. That's not what I'm going to talk about. Up at the top, you see how the Women's Christian Temperance Union was going, this was just before Prohibition started, they were going to the public library and saying to the librarian, we'd like you to burn all of the books on producing alcohol. You know, that's something bad to do, we're about to get it outlawed, and we definitely don't want people having the information about how to produce alcohol. And the librarian said, I don't like this burning books idea, but I'll hide them in the back room so people won't be able to find the books on the shelves. At this point, you're probably thinking, what does this have to do with Apple and the FBI and cryptography, and why am I talking at this cryptographic module conference? And bear with me, I will answer these questions. Let me focus on what these people who were trying to censor the alcohol information were thinking. And this is usually what censors are thinking. If you say to somebody, hey, why are you trying to ban information? Why are you trying to censor information? Then their answer is going to be, think of what happens when somebody receives this information and acts on this information. Think of what happens when somebody gets this book on winemaking and then they make some wine and then they drink it or they give it to somebody else to drink and bad things happen. If you're trying to censor instructions, that's your reason for censoring it, or information generally. You say, this information is bad, these instructions are bad when people act on this information, act on these instructions. Of course, we have freedom of speech, which says, wait a minute, you're not allowed to just censor information. That's not what we accept. And there's a reason for not accepting censorship, which is that, well, when you try to censor information, then first of all, you're not actually stopping people from getting the information. You're not actually going to be able to stop people from finding out how to produce alcohol. We've tried to stop people from producing alcohol with every possible trick in the book, maybe short of mass surveillance. We might want to try it again, but anyway. The previous attempts to have a war on various drugs have not been effective. And then trying to suppress the information, along with whatever the results are of the information, that's not something where it's just something we can innocently do and not have an impact on people. It's something which does damage to lots of innocent people when you try to suppress information. And it's also, look, for the actual bad things that are happening, of course we do have laws, and those laws have some effect on the bad things themselves, where it seems to be ethically about the best that we can do. That's the right trade-off. At least that's what, after centuries of discussions of this stuff, this has been decided as the First Amendment, that, yeah, we're not going to have censorship of information. If people are doing bad things on the basis of information, you ban those bad things. If that's not effective, well, don't try to ban information to have a little more effect. It's not going to help that much, and it's going to do all sorts of damage to society to have that censorship. So, okay, that's the basic position of freedom of speech, and winemaking information and other information has not, in fact, been suppressed. Now, there are exceptions. For instance, some of you were here for the previous talk, and you heard that, yeah, if you shout fire, falsely shout fire in a crowded theater, that's not freedom of speech, not protected by the First Amendment. I've listed various categories of exceptions here. For instance, if you say to somebody, yeah, I'm going to pay you money to break into this bank, then that's intentionally soliciting criminal activity. And if you get arrested for that and you say, freedom of speech, no, sorry, if you intentionally solicit criminal activity, that's not protected by free speech. Because the same trade-offs, society's decided, no, that is too much damage done by allowing that speech. It's clear that we can prohibit this without causing serious damage, And we can recognize these situations as, yeah, courts are okay with, we can prohibit intentionally soliciting criminal activity. Slightly trickier example is, what if you're advocating people doing something illegal? For instance, suppose you're a politician and you say something like, I think it's really important that we deter terrorism by beheading the friends and families of suspected terrorists. That's advocating illegal activity. And now the courts will say, well, okay, are you allowed to do that? Well, is what you just said likely to produce immediate violent action? And for that particular quote I was just giving, the answer is probably no. It's not going to produce immediate violent action. So we have time to discuss it and say, no, that's not the right way to deal with terrorism. You do not go beheading the friends and families of suspected terrorists. You go through a procedure first to decide that they're definitely terrorists, and then you do something bad to them. An example on the other side would be if you say, all right, guys, let's burn down that mosque right now. That would be something that is, depending on the context, that actually can be something which is likely to produce immediate violent action, and that's something which is not protected by freedom of speech. And that's the kind of line that the courts have thought through over many years and decided this is the boundary between free speech and not. And then I've got various examples of false information. For instance, I mentioned the falsely shouting fire from the previous talk. Another example here is fraud. If you deceive people to make a profit deliberately, that's not protected by freedom of speech. Even though you might say, I was just saying this, you know, it was just words coming out of my mouth. No, sorry, that's not allowed. That's not covered by freedom of speech. But the courts have thought about all these and drawn the lines between these exceptions and the general rule that you're not allowed to censor, the government's not allowed to censor anything. All right, what about training videos about breaking into casinos and picking people's pockets? Some of you might have seen this training video. It's actually kind of cool. It's really entertaining and very watchable. Lots of training videos, you kind of fall asleep, but this one is lots and lots of fun. And then you feel like you actually, you know, you're ready to go out there and break into a casino or a bank or, you know, make some money. Or maybe here's a more chilling example. This is a book from 1994 that maybe some of you read, where if you're reading this, especially after 9/11, you read a book from 1994 about a terrorist pilot killing his co-pilot and flying a plane into a building. Okay, it wasn't the World Trade Center, it was Congress, but it's really chilling. It's really terrifying to read this. And yet you immediately have this reaction of, is it right for this kind of speech, this kind of novel to be published? Whether it's labeled as fiction or as a training manual, this is something where it's really on the edge of what seems acceptable. And okay, so maybe we should ban this. And then you find yourself reading a history book about World War II, where there were these suicide pilots, and you say, oh my God, should we allow historians to document this thing because terrorists might have learned from those kamikaze pilots? And then you find yourself reading safety regulations about skyscrapers. Maybe you read a kid's book which says, why are there lights on skyscrapers? Well, because we don't want people flying planes into the skyscrapers. Do we want this information out there? And you start going on this rampage of try to shut down all of this information because maybe terrorists have been acting on the basis of this information. And the reality is that we can't actually stop the terrorists by banning this information. They come up with it themselves, even if they don't have any inspiration. The line that the courts have drawn here is they say, okay, are you, when you're publishing this kind of information, are you intentionally helping criminals? Do you have this guilty state of mind that your goal is to help criminals? If you are, then that's one of the narrow categories of not protected by free speech, not protected by the First Amendment. For instance, there was one case where a murder manual publisher stipulated, said to court, yes, we intended to help murderers and intended murderers. That was our goal in publishing this. And the court said, okay, not free speech. That's the line that the courts draw. If you look at other examples, like, well, the Clancy novel, or suppose there's a book called How to Fish, and some terrorist then escapes off into the wilderness and uses that How to Fish book and stays alive and stays away from the cops. Or what if you have somebody buying this book? I put a link here to Amazon. The reviews are not very good, but there might be better books which tell you how to build your own secret, build a bookcase that's hiding a door. So you can open the bookcase, just like in the movies, and then climb down. And the advertisement for the book says, protect yourself against criminals who are going to be coming into your house. Don't you want your kids to have somewhere safe to hide in the secret bookcase down in the basement? And, okay, that book is not intended to help criminals. But what if it does help a criminal? What if it's a criminal hiding down in the basement, hiding from the police? Well, all of these examples of books that were not intended to help criminals, these are things which are protected as free speech because they're not intended to help criminals, as opposed to the murder manual publisher who said, yes, we did intend to help murderers. All right, here's an example of some instructions that you could follow, not for hiding from the police. This is something where, what's going on here? There's some year as input, 2017, and these instructions tell you, divide year by 100. Okay, 2017 divided by 100 sounds like 20. Add 1 to the result, giving century, 21 is century, and then multiply century by 3, 63, and you go on. You can go on through these instructions. It's cut off. It keeps going for some more lines after the bottom. So these are instructions that you could follow with a year, which will give you some information at the end. Does anybody recognize this programming language? I'm kind of curious.
COBOL.
COBOL, yeah. Yes, I've actually written a COBOL program, I admit it. So these are instructions in COBOL for calculating the date of Easter. You can just run through the instructions, starting with 2017, and figure out the date of Easter this year. You can also look it up on Google. But you can also give these instructions to your COBOL compiler, if you have a COBOL compiler installed, and then run it on your computer. This is working instructions, working software, which means your computer can understand it as well as you understanding it. I should comment, I actually filed this COBOL program as a declaration in a court case some years ago. And I think it was actually something which was really informative for the judge to be able to see that, yeah, this is instructions that the judge can understand. What I'm saying about software, of course, it's completely basic and trivial, and we all know that software is something you can read through and follow yourself. But judges don't understand this. Lawyers don't understand this. Politicians don't understand this. This is something that requires education. Okay, these instructions are something which normally you would not follow these by hand. You would say, have your computer follow the instructions because the computer's much faster at doing this than you are. But the end result is the same. The whole reason that we have these computers doing the calculations, following the instructions in the software, is because the computers get the result a lot faster. And then at the end, you have the same result that you would have doing it by hand. It's just you don't make mistakes. The computer... if you did it by hand, you would make mistakes sometimes, and it would be slow and painful. The computer just gives you the right result instantly. It's obviously much better. Okay. When you see an example of the government, say politicians or government lawyers in court or government lawyers outside of court or FBI directors saying things like, it's really important to regulate software publishing, to control software, to censor software. They won't use the word censor. But when you see them saying, we have to limit the software that gets published, there's a really useful thing to be able to do, which is the main thing that I want to emphasize in this talk, which is take the computer out of their story. Take it out of the picture. Say, what would happen if you're in exactly the same situation, except instead of having a computer, a smartphone following the instructions, you have a human following the instructions. First question to ask is, could they, in that different situation without the computer, could they say exactly what they were saying about the situation with the computer? Could they say, yeah, the result of following those instructions, we're trying to stop that result, and that's why we're trying to stop the instructions, the software, from being published? If you throw away the computer and you almost always get a yes answer to that question, then you ask, well, okay, what are the free speech consequences of that? Is this one of the recognized categories of speech that should be censorable by the government? Let me give some examples to illustrate this. So first one is going dark. There's WhatsApp with more than a billion users. There's Apple with tons of users. There's lots and lots of these encryption products that are out there. And those are protecting lots of innocent people and allowing them to keep their data private and communicate without worrying about criminals getting at their data. But, of course, some of those people are criminals themselves, or maybe terrorists. And those people are also being protected by the same software. And so the FBI says, well, we are going dark. Well, they claim they're going dark. Whether they're actually going dark, that's a different question, not the topic of this talk. But they claim that they're going dark, in particular, because of all of this encryption software that people are using. And so they say, it's really important for us to be able to see what these terrorists and criminals are doing, drug dealers, whatever, see what these bad guys are doing, and get into their files whenever we have to, and stop attacks before they happen. So, okay, let's take the situation where the FBI says ban the encryption software or put in back doors for the FBI to use, and let's get rid of the computer and think about what that means. What would it be like to have software publishing without the computer? Well, here's an example. This is in the files of James Madison that you can find online. This is a letter between Madison and Jefferson. It was a letter from Madison to Jefferson, where if you look closely at it, then you can see that there's a bunch of numbers in the middle. And then when Jefferson got it, he was somehow translating those numbers into some comprehensible, if you stare closely enough, and you're familiar with the way that English was written in script many years ago. It's not too hard to read, but you have to stare closer at it in higher resolution. And you can see Jefferson's translation of those numbers into words. So Jefferson was actually translating this incomprehensible sequence of numbers into words somehow. And Madison was translating his original thoughts into the numbers. And the system that they were using for that was actually designed by Jefferson. So Jefferson, he might be better known as the third president of the U.S., but his actual job, from my perspective, was being a cryptographer. He was one of the original U.S. cryptographers. And, okay, from modern perspective, we know how to do better, but he actually had some pretty good systems for the day. And he was explaining to Madison, hey, Madison, Jimmy Boat, we can encrypt your data. We can encrypt our communications as follows. And, okay, so Madison was following these instructions from Jefferson, just like people today are following instructions from crypto software publishers. The result being that Madison was encrypting his communications to Jefferson. Now, the FBI comes along. Let's fast forward to today. Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson the 20th, still doing crypto, and puts out a book called How to Encrypt, aimed at Madison and whoever else wants to encrypt, and says, here's how to secure your data. There's no computer involved now. You can do it by hand, just like the founding fathers did. And now the FBI says, hey, wait a minute. Some of the people following the instructions in this book are criminals, and we need to be able to look at their communications, need to be able to look at their files. And your book is helping them protect their files from us, and that's wrong. So here's the All Writs Act, or whatever law the government comes up with. You've got to not publish this book. Let's just ban the book. So is the FBI allowed to ban the book that gives instructions which sometimes help criminals? Same question that I was asking before about a how to fish book. And the answer is, if the book is intended to help criminals, the government can censor it. If the book is intended to protect human rights and to stop crime, then the government cannot censor it, cannot ban it. The government's not allowed to just censor instructions. That's a violation of the First Amendment. Lots of times, government lawyers in the last few decades have been forced into court to deal with software issues, and they will typically say things like this. Suppose you have an airplane or a car or some other device that has some computers in it, and suppose that somebody distributes software which does damage to that transportation system or to the electric grid or some other critical thing that our lives rely on. Scary. Obviously, the government has to be able to regulate this. Or maybe the lawyer says, all right, there's the instructions that could be followed by bad guys, but there's also the instructions that fool you. There's, for instance, the example on my slide is a super stock picker app for your smartphone. And then you install the app, and the description says, yeah, this will help you pick stocks. And when you actually run it, of course, you know, you click on OK, I give it access to all my bank accounts and my life savings, and then it actually ends up investing in stocks which are controlled by these thieves, and soon enough, you don't have any money left. And then the government lawyers and politicians looking at these things will say, obviously, we have to be able to regulate software. And yeah, these kinds of software, I would agree, absolutely, these have to be regulated. But let's take the computer away. The argument the government lawyers will give is, or the politicians will give, is we have to have just some ban on software which is within certain criteria, and there's no First Amendment issues. Software and free speech have nothing to do with each other. But, well, let's take the computer out of this picture. Let's imagine the same examples without software, without the computer. Imagine a book that tells people, here's how to destroy the electric grid. Here's how to destroy the navigation system on airplanes. This is maybe at the edge of what security researchers might do, and if your intent is to publish this in order to improve security, then you're okay, you're protected by the First Amendment. If your intent in publishing this book is to help criminals, you're not. That's exactly the line that the courts are familiar with drawing. And it has nothing to do with whether there's a computer, whether there's software. The software is really a distraction from this question. The courts should be looking at, well, is this information intended to help criminals? And that's what they do look at when you face them with a book. If you have, in the second case, the super stock picker or some app that fools people, all right, imagine instead of an app, it's a book. It's a book which is published by some con artist, and they put something, okay, maybe online, or maybe they actually publish some book with some real publisher. They fool the publisher and put out some book which is saying, yeah, here's how to pick stocks. And if you follow the instructions, then ha-ha, they're getting all your money. And it has exactly the same effect as the app. You've been fooled into following these instructions, which are having a really bad effect. And the courts know how to handle that as well. The courts say that's fraud. And that's not something which we allow protected by freedom of speech. So in all these examples, the computer is not actually part of the picture. The argument for censoring this kind of software is the same as the argument for censoring instructions that humans are following. And the free speech considerations are the same whether there's a computer involved or not. I'd like to give a little bit of history here. For people who don't recognize the picture, this is a Russian agent, according to the FBI. I should emphasize I'm talking about historical facts. I'm not commenting on current issues. But there is a memo online, which is from the domestic intelligence head at the FBI in 1963, which refers to Martin Luther King Jr., the person in the previous picture, as the most dangerous Negro of the future in this nation from the standpoint of communism, the Negro, and national security. Eventually convinced Attorney General Kennedy to authorize full surveillance of King's life, with the effort to disrupt his life and, if possible, prove that he was a Russian agent. Didn't prove he was a Russian agent, did catch some interesting tapes of him in hotel rooms with some women other than his wife, which they eventually, the FBI got kind of pissed off after King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and they sent him anonymously. Later on in FBI files, there was a congressional investigation, and FBI files showed that they had the letter. They sent him anonymously a letter which was encouraging him to commit suicide in fairly explicit terms and was saying, yeah, here's a tape of your recent activities. Huh, I wonder where that came from. And, well, he didn't commit suicide. He was assassinated. There's some beeps which I should shut off. He was assassinated in 68, but that was after NSA started its own surveillance of King as a potential foreign agent. Some years later, public key cryptography came along and was instantly, obviously, a threat to the ability of NSA and other agencies to spy on everybody, in particular, potential Russian agents like King. And so Joseph Meyer from NSA sent a letter to the organizers of a crypto conference saying, you better not allow those people like Diffie and Hellman and Merkel to give talks. Well, the IEEE organizing that conference said, we're going ahead with our conference, but This is just an example of what NSA wanted to continue to do to try to disrupt democracy. A little farther forward, obviously this is a very selective history, but just a little bit of stuff I was involved in. Some point in 93, I sent some software and a paper to NSA. And I said, actually, here's a spectrum of things, where on one end was very much like a normal paper, a couple pages, but it looked like a paper. On the other end was software. And in between, I actually sent a spectrum of five items which were kind of interpolating between the paper and the software. And obviously, they couldn't really draw a line there, so they eventually said, yeah, all of that is munitions. You're not allowed to publish any of that, not allowed to export any of that. In 1995, NSA told a court officially that its goal was to control the widespread foreign availability of cryptographic devices and software, which might hinder its foreign intelligence collection efforts. But, oh no, oops, not a paper. We definitely wouldn't want to control a paper. That would be really embarrassing if we were trying to censor a paper. That would be a free speech violation, right? So they told me that it was okay to publish the paper. What they were thinking was something like the following. We don't actually want crypto to get out there at all. If you throw the computer out of this, then what you get, so same transition again that I'm trying to emphasize, is if you see a situation where the government's trying to censor software publishing, trying to stop software publishing, get rid of the software and ask, what's their motivation? The answer is, same motivation. They could have said, we're trying to stop people from outside the country from following encryption instructions, because that could hinder our foreign intelligence collection efforts. Same rationale, no computer involved. Of course, if you look at the 1977 letter and the 1993 controlling the paper and various other incidents, you see they of course believe this rationale. But when I dragged them into court, then they didn't really want to be in the position of trying to censor something that looked like a scientific paper. So they drew a line at software, thinking, all right, that's what really matters. So in court, they said, all right, software is what is most important, gonna have the most users. Let's see if we can confuse the judge about software. And the end result of that was not a confused judge. The judge said, contrary to defendant's suggestion, the functionality of a language does not make it any less like speech. It was very nice to be reading through examples that the judge was pulling out. I mean, some of them are kind of scary. For instance, like a manual about building a hydrogen bomb. But recipes, do-it-yourself manuals, all of these things, the courts should be asking the same questions of what is the intent of publishing this information. That's the standard way to decide, is it free speech or not? And the judge went on, I won't go through the whole thing, there were more examples like a player piano, role of code for a player piano, is producing music, but it's still language, it's still speech, which can be understood by a human or by a machine. And then, well, at the end the judge was saying, the government basically is saying, once language allows you to do something, like play music or make lasagna, the language is no longer speech. The logic of this proposition is dubious at best. Its support in First Amendment law is non-existent. And then one of the appeals judges, after the government appealed this, they lost the appeal, and one of the interesting quotes from the appellate decision was one of the judges saying, the fact that computers will soon be able to respond directly to spoken commands should not confer on the government the unfettered power to impose prior restraints on speech in an effort to control its functional aspects. Now, I'm only giving some positive quotes from judges here, but I don't want to oversell how much the judges understand. This is something where the kind of translation that I'm talking about here and that some judges understood, that's something which lots of judges do not understand. Lots of lawyers do not understand. Let me finish with one last slide here on Apple versus FBI. Last example of let's get rid of the computer and think through what this means. So Apple versus FBI. Okay, it's not Apple anymore. It's Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson the 20th. And Jefferson has his How to Encrypt book. And now that's being used by Madison and by lots of good people, but there's also this evil terrorist, Farouk, who's using the How to Encrypt instructions. And now the FBI is trying to get Farouk's information. And they've got this brilliant idea of coming to Jefferson with the All Writs Act and saying, all right, you are obliged to help us get at Farouk's data. by corrupting your how to encrypt instructions and turning them into instructions, anti-encryption instructions, which Farouk is going to follow those because you're going to say, yes, I'm Jefferson, I approve of this message. And Farouk is then going to be fooled into giving us his data. Do that for us, for your country. And otherwise, we're going to drag you to court. And, well, Jefferson says, no, these instructions are too dangerous to create. This has nothing to do with software, nothing to do with computers. The only reason that lawyers throw in software and computers, government lawyers trying to win these cases, is because they know that judges don't understand software. What the analysis should say is simply, Supreme Court says that freedom of speech includes you have the freedom of what not to say. And Jefferson does not want to write anti-encryption instructions, so the government is not entitled to demand that from him. But actually getting to this conclusion requires stripping away the software from the picture. So to finish, what I'd like to emphasize here is that when you see people saying, yeah, we have to stop software publishing for the following reasons, software is not covered by freedom of speech, then ask, what is software actually doing in that picture? The reality is that the software, we're using the software just to do something faster and more reliably than we would have accomplished by doing it ourselves. So suppose we just do it ourselves, then what happens to the government argument? And basically always the answer is, yeah, the courts know how to handle that. You strip away the software and you get to something that the judges can understand. Thank you for your attention.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I'm very sympathetic with what you've described, but I want to push back a little bit on the idea that you can just erase the computer from the picture, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it. So when we're looking at mass surveillance, one of the arguments often given for a large mass surveillance regime is, well, we could just send a cop out and watch, the cop could watch and write down in a notebook the license plate of every car that goes into the parking lot. But we have an automated license plate reader, and we do that. It's the same thing. If you're okay with us sending a cop to go sit in a car and write down everyone's license plate, then you ought to be fine with us installing automated license plate readers at every corner of every intersection in the city. And I would argue, as an anti-surveillance advocate, that there is actually something qualitatively different about the fact that it's a computerized system and the fact that the scale and the effect that the scale has. So I'm curious about how you, maybe you disagree with me, or if you don't, then how you reconcile that with this talk.
I do disagree, and let me take this as another exercise in stripping away the computer from the picture. So you have a scenario, nightmare scenario, where there are, let's envision it as computers, let's say there's an army of 1 billion Raspberry Pis which are watching your every move. And then, this is terrifying because of the scale of it. Computers allow this automation of mass surveillance. Okay, let's strip away the computer. Suppose that the government hires 50 million people to carry out this surveillance. Now, that's something where if you look at Supreme Court decisions regarding surveillance, then they have very frequently said, yeah, it's because this is targeted, because it's aimed at particular people that we're only going to focus on the kind of narrow impact there. The occasions when the Supreme Court's been faced with much wider scale surveillance, which this would also be if the government hired 50 million people to do an Orwellian-style surveillance of everybody. The occasional Supreme Court decisions on that type of situation, the Supreme Court has focused exactly on the scale of it. It's not the automation. That's just a tool to produce the scale. The scale is what has the judges saying, wait a minute, there is actually a really serious problem here. There is, for instance, a recent Supreme Court decision, which is saying, I won't get the exact quote from memory, but basically it's saying there is a real difference between doing an occasional bit of surveillance on somebody and doing wide-scale surveillance of entire lives. And their emphasis there is not on the computer. The emphasis is on the scale. And that's exactly the distinction that's showing up in your scenario.
Right. So I agree with that analysis, but your earlier discussion about the difference between the book that describes how to do the crypto and the machine that can do the crypto actually is a difference from a functionality perspective of scale. The number of crypto operations that I can do with my pen and paper and the number of crypto operations that I can do with a machine seem to be different because of scale. And so I think we're actually in agreement in terms of the social and political outcomes that we want, but I think the idea that you can just remove the computer from the picture when, in fact, there are questions of scale that come because of the computer is something that we need to be able to grapple with.
So I would, again, disagree with the concept that the computer is what's creating the problem. The computer is something where, for us as law-abiding citizens who want to conveniently protect ourselves, the computer is a tremendously valuable thing. And then for the criminals, it's less of a benefit because they're willing to go to quite a bit of effort anyway. But fundamentally, the questions about what the government is allowed to do or not allowed to do under the First Amendment, the question of what's protected as freedom of speech or not, those questions are not about whether it was automated. The question is, what were the results? And if you do something which your intent is to help criminals, then it doesn't matter what the scale is. If you do something where your intent is not to help criminals, it doesn't matter what the scale is. If you're on the government side of it and you're surveilling people's entire lives, if you have a Stasi-style setup where everybody's being monitored, then that's not acceptable, according to the bits of Supreme Court decisions that have looked at this. Of course, the government tries to stop the Supreme Court from actually investigating these things. It's been quite difficult to get any actual court decisions on these topics of mass surveillance. But to the extent that the Supreme Court has looked at, is it okay to do mass surveillance, their answer has been pretty consistently no. And it's something where I'm actually optimistic that they'll continue to push exactly that distinction into the future. It really matters whether the government is surveilling 100 people, 1,000 people, or 1,000,000 people.
Any other questions?
So doesn't that argument also depend on the depth of the surveillance? For instance, the police have been able to do helicopters to do speed traps for basically forever. And that would, you could argue that you're surveilling everybody who goes through those two lines on the interstate because they, you know, do their little stopwatch or whatever.
Yeah, so roads are an interesting case in the law where there's lots of kind of special case ad hoc jurisprudence regarding roads because they're not viewed as something you have the right to use. You have to be licensed to drive a car, and you don't have a right to drive a car, and there's all sorts of rules about the interactions between the people who are driving and the government exactly because it's not viewed as something that people have the right to do. And there are serious safety issues which are motivating this. I'm not sure that everything that's happened as a result of that is ethically acceptable, but the starting point for roads is very particular to roads, and the fact that the government can set up stops on roads, for example, and can set up speed traps, all of this has been approved by courts because people are not viewed as having a right to drive a car, except on their own property. But if you're on a public road, then you don't have a right to do that. You're licensed to do that. And the result of that is that, yeah, if you're driving your car along, then the government puts all sorts of constraints on you.
Fair point. I think another example is the, I'm going to get the specifics wrong, but I thought that police officers were allowed to request identification because that was considered to be not terribly infringing, although you were allowed to refuse, you know, if you're just walking down the street.
Yeah, the usual escalation depends whether you're white or black. For people who are white, it works as follows. The cop says, what are you doing there? And you say, oh, just waiting for a friend. The cop goes away. Maybe if the cop is suspicious, the cop says, can I see your identification? You say, I'd rather not, and the cop goes away. If you're black, it's a different procedure. The law seems, as far as I understand it, to say that the police, if they have probable cause to arrest you, they can arrest you. If they have some suspicion that you're doing something wrong, then it's wimpier rules. They can't just arbitrarily detain you. They can't arbitrarily ask you for your ID. But realistically, for a lot of people in society right now, they have a different experience of how the procedures work.
Right. Yeah, Chuck, no, go ahead. But just what I want to say is, Chuck, 1 second. It's 2:24 per my clock. So officially, this is the close of time. But since we have the track, the room available, the track is open, go ahead and ask questions and continue talking and continue. putting him on the spot.
No, I want to say thank you this time
so that whoever wants to leave can leave, not feel bad about it and walk around or whatever. Okay? So thank you very much, Daniel. That was very interesting. And by the way, I did figure out how to pronounce that university. I asked him, how do you pronounce that? And he said, just say, I don't understand. It's some vague university from Netherlands. So I think it's called Techniek University Edenhaven.
Close enough, yeah. There? Yeah, almost.
Netherlands. All right, thank you once again.
All right, thanks. All right, I guess for people who are still here, I'll stick around and answer questions.
So would it be fair to say that targeting is basically the thing that's the big delta, and well, you know, if you're targeting a search, you're more likely to be in an area of legality versus no targeting at all. And this is the you know, like a NSA doesn't target, so they capture everything because they can. Though if they did do targeting, they would actually be able to specifically go after what they're looking for, and then it would not be nearly as damaging to civil liberties.
Certainly a lot of the recent discussions have focused on exactly the question of what's targeted, but I worry about how to recognize that situation. For example, I've heard that when NSA or CIA is breaking into a computer, that is targeted. But then what if they do that to a billion computers or a billion smartphones? Well, that's, from their perspective, a billion targets.
In practice, it's usually you have an objective or there's something, there's a collection requirement that usually is what drives the targeting.
Yes, you have an objective. The objective is to stop people from democratically organizing, for example, for civil rights for black people. And talk to people who are involved in the Occupy movement or Black Lives Matter, and you'll get a different idea of what's actually going on in society today.
I'm thinking more about, there's the positive aspects of this when you're, I don't know, have people in harm's way and you're using cyber effects to keep them from getting killed. So that's where you can do targeting, in the opposite event where it is a narrow band. Hey, I'm going to target that thing, disable it so that, you know, the guys I'm sending, just, you know, soldiers, not dealing in political things at all. The guys, you know, people that, like myself at one point in my career. So I just note that I think, and having seen the possibility of what happens when you do targeting, you can do a narrow effect. And some of these things are, but why that's important is that when someone says, well, I'm going to target everybody, that the point of mass surveillance, all of what, you know, the NSA has done, they don't, it just demonstrates that when you hear the excuse, well, we have to do it this way because there is no other way. Well, that's not true. I'm actually reinforcing your point by saying that it is able to do the same sort of techniques on a narrower band, but it requires, you know, some different community, you know, different cooperation, using, fusing of other intelligence types, like, you know, human intelligence, and not depending on the technology to do everything for you. So going back to the idea of, you know, if you can do things narrowly, the capabilities shouldn't be taken away, because they can be, you know, much simpler to disable something, you know, do something where, hey, if I'm going to go blow something up, hey, how about I just blow up the things that are military and not, you know, not military? A great example, I was actually explaining this earlier. There was an exercise where the some aspect of U.S. Cyber Command was doing a target, basically, how would we target something versus the Chinese? And this is the effect issue was, is that we would use the capabilities that NSA has at its disposal, but targeted so that we would take out a part of the power grid that is actually making sure that a radar station, you know, is up, so that we can have planes fly through and do whatever they were doing, what their kinetic military objective was, demonstrating targeting. Now, the inverse would be if we decide not to see the value in something, and where we perhaps go off the rails a little bit, is what happens with the idea based off of known practices of, let's say, China. They just take out the entire power grid. You know, but so the idea being, some of these capabilities, if used correctly, do have a positive benefit, can actually save lives, versus what if you let them out of control, and that's usually where the term targeting does come in. It is that is the intent to use the collection mechanism or offensive mechanism or defensive mechanism to a point. So it's really an evaluation of, ask yourself the question, what are you targeting? So the Occupy group, I'm targeting them for what reason? Well, if you can't have a legitimate objective, I'm targeting them because I don't agree with them, that's bad. If I'm targeting them for some other purpose, then hey, maybe there's a military objective, there's something for the national, a legitimate national security concern. But it gives you an opportunity, if you have to answer that question, what is the targeting for? Then you can actually say, where is the justification of this thing? So it's more on the, and that, now this is a different perspective coming from the other, a potential other angle of what would be someone who would use these capabilities, what is a way to maintain a degree of, a moral compass? And it goes back to, if I am the person to do this thing, what is the reason I'm doing it? And can I actually say it's narrowly focused? And if I can't, then you're probably running into a really big problem.
So I think I'll refrain from commenting on the questions of moral compass for the intelligence community, because when you have a million people involved in something, it's going to be impossible to have them all on the same path. What I think is something important, and what the coming crypto battles are going to be about, is whether software publishers are free to provide defensive tools for everybody to protect themselves against China and whoever else might be doing bad things. So the question of what capabilities are available for attackers, I would rather focus on making sure that it's legitimate for the rest of us under US law and preferably laws of other places to publish the defensive tools that society needs.
Wouldn't that be so funny that the jokes about the Second Amendment from 2008 suddenly become legitimate? Who says the arms had to be firearms?
Yeah.
Scary thought. Yeah, setting me up. There.
Okay, I'm still around if people have more questions.